Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this special edition of the 42 Fire American Soccer Show, as the United States women's national team, on a very big challenge from the Dutch women, they go on a big second half, two goals scored by the USA, and they win their fourth World Cup title by a final of 2-0 post-game here, the Women's World Cup post-game show between the United States and the Dutch of the Netherlands. Join me right now, Carter Krishnayer of World Soccer Talk. Hopefully she'll be finding a nice quiet spot to join in Araceli Villanueva. But, Carter, while this match was very entertaining, and at times, you know, I thought the USA women bit of a slow start. They worked their way through the entire first 45 to get back to where we know that they can play. This was a match where you got to give credit to the Dutch because they had a game plan and they almost executed it. But the United States found a way and got some help from VAR in the long run. They found a way to go and get their fourth championship in the Women's World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you keep applying pressure, which is what the U.S. did, you're eventually going to get a bit of clumsy defending, as good as the Dutch had been in the first 60 minutes defensively. And that's what that was. High boot, unnecessary, as Morgan is moving away from goal. But Megan Rapinoe, who did not have a good match, in my opinion, she's not had a great World Cup, to be honest with you. You know, she's won the Golden Boot. She slots at home. I think what we saw in the first half, Daniel, so you're talking about the U.S. Maybe starting slow. The U.S., I thought, started very well in the first 10 minutes. That final ball was lacking, and oftentimes it was Rapinoe and Heath, who have so much quality, not delivering that final ball or not playing the touch quickly enough. And then after that, the Dutch were able to really get their shape organized. They were very solid defensively from that point in the rest of the half. Obviously, they looked dangerous on the counter, although the Dutch have been accustomed to playing with the ball a lot in midfield, particularly in second halves of games in this World Cup, and having their dynamic trio up front run the channels, play off of one another. That never was really there today. I think when you look at the post-mortems on this World Cup, we're going to talk about how even though there were defensive frailties with the U.S. Coming into this tournament, and there was a lot of concern about Crystal Dunn playing left back, that she really acquitted herself well, and that the two center backs, some thought about Becky Sauerbrunn being maybe a little bit over it at her age. And obviously, Abby Dahlkamp, I think we had fewer question marks about entering the tournament, particularly considering how well she's played in NWSL the last few seasons. They really acquitted themselves well. And this is a remarkable achievement, Daniel, also because I know the narrative on Fox has been how deep the U.S. team is, but they really weren't. I mean, we didn't see Mal Pugh really feature in this World Cup after the group stage. We didn't see Ali Long. We didn't see Emily Sonnet. We didn't see Tierna Davidson. We didn't see any of these players. Jessica McDonald, another one. That was a very controversial selection by Ellis. That were supposed to provide some sort of squad depth. And I had, before the tournament, justified McDonald's selection with saying, well, Ellis has a particular tactical thought in mind for her in the knockout stage. Well, clearly that wasn't the case. She didn't play at all. So this was a team that was really only 15 or 16 deep, and they were able to withstand not only the competition, but what was, in reality, Daniel, a very hot World Cup in terms of climate, the difficulty in playing in that, those sorts of conditions. Now, of course, you could argue that the U.S., because our players are in NWSL and they play in the middle of the summer, are more equipped to deal with that than the European sides that were the other contenders, the Dutch, the English, the French, the Swedes, et cetera. That's also quite true. But still a remarkable accomplishment. And I think when we look back at this, we have to talk about the fact that the U.S. took five or six squad players. I think I forgot to mention Allie Long and Morgan Brian. Morgan Brian, who was so instrumental 4 years ago in the U.S. Lifting the trophy, who did not play at all in the knockout stage. Ellis had a set team. The only question mark was whether you start Sammy Mears or you start Lindsey Horan. The chemistry, the understanding of each other's games, so important. And then, of course, I think, Daniel, you nailed it early in the tournament. Got to give you credit here. You said Rose Lavelle for you was the star of this team, the breakout star. She's the breakout star of this entire World Cup, all 24 teams. I mean, it's been remarkable to see her because, you know, I had a lot of concerns about her being not in the team. I think she should have been in the World Cup, but I had a lot of concerns about her starting before the World Cup when it was obvious in those pre-tournament friendlies that Ellis was starting her. I thought, and then I assumed she'd come out of the team after, you know, Ertz returned to the midfield. Remember, Ertz had to start in central defense because of Salvra being injured at the beginning of the tournament. That Lavelle, to me, doesn't fit into a tactical setup, right? She's a very kind of free-flowing player. She can play with both her feet. She's very, you know, she's almost, it's almost in a tactical setup. This is a men's analogy. It's almost like a Paul Pogba type player. You know, you don't know how you fit her in, right? You don't necessarily, and you don't know what kind of player to drop. Do you drop a Mewis? Do you drop a Horan to fit her in a three-woman midfield? But that ability to use both feet, that ability to cut inside, that ability to push wide when needed to allow even O'Hara coming from right back to cut inside, she just read the game perfectly. Tactically, she really evolved in this tournament. And, she's the breakout star. You know, we came into the tournament thinking we were going to see Keith, Rapinoe, Morgan as the stars. Now, maybe for casual people who don't watch the game the way we do, they're going to say those three because they scored the most goals or whatever. But, I mean, for me, Lavelle was the pulse and heartbeat of this team. And credit to you, Daniel. You called it very early on.
You know, I got to tell you, I loved how she performs, Rose Lavelle. She only said Lavelle, excuse me. Rose Lavelle, I thought, you know, she had a great motor on the pitch. There she is right now wearing number 16 as the USA is waiting for their first place medals, of course. The Dutch will go first. We still have Fox on right now watching the presentation of all these individual trophies being handed out to some of these players, of course, that have done well. Golden boot, silver boot, golden gloves, silver gloves, everything. Alex Morgan now will be heading over to the podium to earn her individual award. But, of course, that trophy, as everyone sees right now, she says hello to Gianni Infantino and the president of the country of France.
Yep.
You know, getting all the accolades, including – Carlos Cordero, president of U.S. Soccer, so many former American superstars that are on this national team from the past that have won their respective World Cups as well. Megan Rapinoe also taking accolades as well, earning her title Golden Boot. Congratulations to Megan Rapinoe as she gets the accolades as well from everybody there on that podium. All you can say really is that back to Rose Lavelle, like I said, I liked her high motor. I thought she was really, really strong. I really thought that she brought an added character to this national team. Not that they didn't really need it, but you know as well as I do There will be possibly some of these players that probably will not be suiting up for the national team again, probably not for another World Cup, maybe for the upcoming Olympics for Japan in 2020. But we don't know if they'll be making it to the next Women's World Cup in 2023. So, you know, to me, Rose Lavelle is the, shall I say, you know, part of the next generation of this Women's World Cup. We don't know if Rapinoe will be back. We don't know if Alex Morgan will be back. You never know. They might not make it to another World Cup. And that's not a slight or anything. I just feel like, you know, you got to see who's going to take – there she goes, Rose Lavelle. She'll be earning an award today as well, and that's good for her. She's done some wonderful things, and very happy for her. There it is, a bronze ball for her. Good for her. You know, she's earned it. And, you know, what can you say about Rose Lavelle? She's just been unbelievable.
Yeah. You know, so, Daniel, I mean, I think you make a good point about the transition of the squad. Mal Pugh, who we didn't see much of in this World Cup, I think she's going to have an important role to play going forward. Lindsay Horan, who, you know, we all have our biases in terms of players we like and style of players we like. I mean, Lindsay Horan is, for me, you know, up there among my favorite players in the world, men's or women. So I'm disappointed she didn't get to play in the final. But she's going to be an important part of that future for this team. Crystal Dunn, probably moving forward, replacing Megan Rapinoe as your left-sided wide player, is going to be a very important piece of this national team going forward. The Olympics are going to be a place where maybe Rapinoe and Lloyd say goodbye to the international game. Maybe Becky also, Salbrun, who ended up having a pretty good World Cup after, I think, some of us had some concern about Becky actually starting in this World Cup and thought maybe you're better using Julie Ertz as a center back. And then you can fit Horan, Mewis, and Lavelle in the same midfield. But, you know, I think what we saw as the tournament wore on was that Ertz and Mewis were a really good pair. And you had to keep them together, and Lavelle was just playing too well to keep her out. So Horan's the odd person out there. It's going to be interesting because I think this the coming Olympic Games, there's going to be a really good Japanese side, young Japanese side that we saw bloodletted in this tournament. They didn't get back to the finals, obviously been to the last two World Cup finals before this, but they knew that. They deliberately went with the younger side to get them ready. They're going to be very tough. I think this Dutch team is going to be tough as well in the Olympics next summer. And there are also, you know, other stories that have come out of this World Cup that potentially, you know, you could say Phil Neville botched his tactics, and he has, you know, a good core of younger players on England that will be part of the Team GB next summer. So that's going to be interesting because I think as we transition, I had thought that you would be looking at Lindsay Horan and now as the two standout players going forward for the U.S. And now Rose Lavelle has done it on the world stage. Let me not forget, Morgan Bryan is still pretty young. She didn't play except for that one Chile game, I guess, in this World Cup. But she's beginning to get back to the level she was at a few years ago when she was so influential as a 22-year-old who just come out of the University of Virginia on that 2015 World Cup team and was such a big part of us winning that trophy. So there are still some pieces, but certainly I think your point is very well taken that Lavelle is going to be the player to build around. She's going to be the player now, I think, that the opposition tries to game plan for. So what's happened against the United States recently, the last year or two, is the teams that have faced the U.S. have been most concerned about Copenhagen. You saw that in this World Cup. That's why I think Copenhagen was less effective than maybe people thought she'd be, because she gets the bulk of defensive attention because she's got the ability to break down defenses. You saw it, actually, at the end of the match on the massive stretch. You know, one-on-one, she's just a phenomenal player. But now I think Lavelle, who's got more of a motor than he's even, and can go end-to-end, actually, Heath can do that too, but, you know, in the center of the pitch, he doesn't necessarily need to be in wide areas. That's just a dynamic kind of game changer. You know, I'm coming up with this analogy on the fly, Daniel. Maybe I'll think about it after we're done with the show and correct myself. But I'm thinking, or maybe I won't. Maybe I'll own it. I'm thinking she's got a lot of Pogba in her, and they're both world champions.
Yep. No, absolutely. The Dutch now have already accepted their second place medal. The head of the women's side of the Dutch FA gives her players and her coach, her top coach, congratulations. And now, as the Dutch are taking their photos with the sign, with their second place medals, and, you know, give them credit, they absolutely did a good job there.
Giving
the USA a solid fight. They gave them a solid fight, Clark. That's all you can really ask. I thought they defended very well. There was a moment where, you know, like I said, they're trying to catch the U.S. on a counter. There was a moment where the U.S., they fell asleep at the wheel in their end in the first half, and I thought that the Dutch were going to take advantage. But, you know, thankfully the USA were able to get back and find a way to not get scored on. And now they're going to back to the podium now to earn their first-place medals and soon celebrating with that title for the fourth time in the history of the women's game for U.S. soccer.
Yeah, so, you know, you make a good point about the Dutch. I think they had a great tournament. Jackie Groden was the other real breakout player in this tournament alongside Rose Lavelle. Some people would say that maybe Georgia Stanaway could have been on that list. Had Phil Neville been less apt to rotate his squad the way he did for England. But, I thought the Dutch, the mistake they made today, and I understand they were trying to play on the counter, but when you have Spitsa and you have Groden in that midfield, and Van de Donk, right, you have three really good midfielders. It seemed like because they were trying to play on the break, what they were trying to do is play through that midfield quickly. And I think that the asset that midfield, that three-woman midfield showed times in this tournament, although today they were playing really with four in the midfield because of trying to defend in two banks of four, is their ability to knock the ball around at tempo in the opposition half when in possession. They never really got a chance to do that today except between minutes 40 and 45. And to me, it's not a coincidence that's when the Dutch were most dangerous. The Dutch had a few chances to score right before halftime after not really exhibiting a threat except on, you know, the counters in the first 40 minutes and really not threatening again until they fell behind 2-0 in the 70th minute or whenever. That best spell of play they had was when they went back to doing what they do best and what they've done best in this tournament, what got them to this final, what got them winning the Euros 2 years ago. So the U.S., you got to give Jill Lawless credit again, because tactically she understood if you let Groden and Van de Donk have too many touches and start dictating play and you know, pushing the ball around midfield at tempo, side to side, moving your defenders out of position, opening up the gaps between Dahlkemper and Sauerbrunn, as the English did very effectively in the second half. And Ellen White ran through that channel a couple times. Thought she had an equalizer, of course, that was chalked off by VAR. You then open yourself up to the danger of Martins, Berenstain, and Medema, who, of course, she's great with both her feet, much like Rose Lavelle, running those channels, finding that space.
Kardec, one second. Johnny Infantino just handed the trophy to the USA women, and they raise it to the sky as the United States, the U.S. Soccer Federation, for the fourth time in the women's game, are world champions, as USA women are going to celebrate, and it's party time in Lyon. Big moment for American soccer, for the women's game as a whole, the best of the best. And they are unapologetic on how they've done it. Whether you don't like how they overstepped celebrated while you thought they scored too many goals against Thailand, whether you didn't like a certain celebration against our friends across the pond, the truth is, if you can't stop them, you're never going to get it. You'll be steamrolled. The USA Women's National Team has lifted their fourth World Cup trophy in the history of the women's game. Continue, please, Cardiff.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think tactically, Joel has figured out that you don't want your defense shifting, having being pulled out of position, and you don't want particularly, that Dutch midfield, you particularly don't want Gronin and Van de Donk getting a lot of touches and a lot of space, time and space. That way, then, Martins and the others can run through those channels, right? So that was a really smart tactical plan defensively, playing with almost a double pivot in those situations of Mewis and Ertz, and they played so well together in this tournament because you saw it with Medema, who has something like 60 goals and 80 caps, some number like that. I don't know the exact number. And she won't turn 23 until next week. I mean, she is when – we saw it in the Euros, and we saw it in World Cup qualifying. We've seen it at times in this tournament. When she's left one-on-one with defenders, she can kill the U. And there was a brief moment, remember where she, where there was a lot of, kind of desperate defending, and finally it was cleared against her, the one opportunity she had, maybe she took a few too many touches. That was the danger. So denying the service to Berenstain, Martins and Medema, I think, was so important. And that was, again, a byproduct of Ertz, who does a lot of understated things in the team. And then I think Dahlkemper and Sauerbrunn being on the same page today, not getting torn apart. The Dutch very clearly had seen how Ellen White was able to expose that for England. In a way that the French didn't, right? The French were very reliant on set pieces. I think also Alyssa Nair, when she had to step up, really stepped up in this tournament. She wasn't tested as much as Hope Solo was in 2015. I mean, I think we all know the story of 2015. The U.S. won that World Cup without being the best team in that tournament. A lot of it was goalkeeping saves. A lot of it was timely goals. A lot of it was good luck. I think this tournament, in spite of the grind of these last few games, the U.S. was clearly the best team. They were always in control. They were always either in control of the matches or playing at a stalemate. They were never playing on the back foot like we saw in 2015. We even saw it in the group stage in 2015, quite honestly. I mean, that was why I think there were so many concerns about Jill Ellis. We saw it in the group stage in 2015. Saw it in the knockout stage until Lauren Cheney's or Lauren Holiday's injury. I think she was Holiday by that time. I think she got married by that time. But until her suspension forced a tactical change. And then in the 2016 Summer Olympics, we saw similar issues. Although, I think in fairness, in 2016, Ellis was trying to bloodlet Crystal Dunn and Emily Sonnen and some other players, younger players. So that might be what we see next summer. The 23 that went this summer to the World Cup and have lifted the trophy, Daniel, I don't know, since you mentioned the Summer Olympics, I don't know how many of these 23 will be there next summer, maybe 15. I think we're going to see some changes, younger changes. And just finishing up here on Alyssa Nair, she now has really established herself as the U.S. number one. I think a lot of us have felt to watch NWSL. I haven't watched NWSL as closely in the last year as I used to, but had felt like I still followed the league, obviously. I thought that France would be the U.S. goalkeeper by the time this World Cup rolled around and would be the U.S. goalkeeper for the foreseeable future. She's been left on the bench, right? She was on this team. But Nair's performances make you think that France is going to have to wait a little longer, maybe 2023. So if any player did, I don't think any player other than Rose Lavelle did more to elevate her stock in this World Cup on that U.S. team than Alyssa Nair. I mean, she just – and obviously had the penalty save against England, right? If she doesn't take that Steph Houghton penalty, where things are very different, right? Because England has the momentum, they're tied, they're level, and at that point they were the better team. So as much as I say the U.S. was comfortable the entire tournament, a big part of being comfortable was Nair coming up with critical saves against both England, or penalty save against England, and some important saves against Spain also, when the Spanish were really in that game.
Yep, absolutely, Clark. And, you know, once again, to see what has happened here with this women's team, how loaded they are and how solid they are. I mean, it's just one of those things where you have to say that, you know, it's amazing to have all this talent in the women's game in our country. Pardon me. That it's interchangeable parts all of a sudden. It's like, you know, you worry about some of these newer players. Well, can they handle the big stage? You know, can they, you know, come to the world's big stage in, you know, the World Cup? If they haven't played an Olympic game yet, can they do it in a Women's World Cup or, you know, World Cup qualifying? You know, that's a bigger stage too. And, you know, those are the three big stages right now for the women, unless they're playing across, you know, if they're playing across the pond, if they're playing in Europe for those big clubs. We know Lloyd can do it.
Yeah.
Krieger can do it. Morgan can do it. But can some of these younger ones do it? And now they're putting up a stat now on Fox. Apparently, Jill Ellis is the first head coach for the women. Second, whether it's a man or a woman, to win consecutive World Cup tournaments in consecutive cycles. I mean, that's amazing. Where have you seen that before?
Yeah. No, you've never seen that before, and I don't think in the men's game there's even been a coach that's won more than one World Cup as a manager. I'm not sure. I don't know. Maybe in the 1950s or 1960s there was. Brazil won a lot of World Cups in that period. But I don't think – look, I mean, it doesn't always end well. Alf Ramsey, Sir Alf Ramsey, hero of you know, knighted, wins the World Cup, the Men's World Cup, 1966 for England. 1970, they lose in the quarterfinals. It affects the national election, which, as I tweeted about yesterday, in the UK. Then they can't qualify for the Euros in 72 or the World Cup in 74, and he gets sacked. Sometimes, you know, these things don't go well. It has not gone well for Yogi Love since Germany won the World Cup. Yeah, they got to the semifinals of the Euros, but it never felt like they were going to win that tournament. They didn't play very well. And then we saw what happened in the World Cup 2018. We see what's happened in the Nations League, right? They bomb out of the end and they get relegated. The Dutch and the French put them to the sword. So it's such a difficult thing in this sport. We saw it even here with the U.S. as we cycled through managers. Now, Pia Sundhage did win two Olympic gold medals in a row as a manager. I do want to point that out in 08 and 12 as the U.S. manager. Obviously, she didn't win the World Cup in 2011, got to the final, and then left after the 2012 Olympics to go manage Sweden, eliminated the U.S. in 2016 Olympics, got to the Olympic final in 2016, so she went three straight finals, lost to Germany, but you know, got called a coward and all that stuff by Hope Solo, as we remember. But I do want to point out Pia also won consecutive tournaments. They just won consecutive World Cups, but still unbelievable achievement for Jill Ellis. And the fact that we're talking about it being two coaches, two USA coaches that have won consecutive tournaments like that is pretty remarkable. I can't think of the men's game of that ever happening. I mean, obviously, Del Bosque won a World Cup and a Euro back-to-back, but remember the first Euro they won in 08 was Spain. I'm talking about Luis Aragonés, the late Aragonés won that Euro. So to win two successive World Cups as a manager, especially, I think this is important. I hate to bring this up. I don't want to pick too much on our colleagues in the American soccer press, but I'm about to. So hold your horses. And I include myself in this. I include myself in some of the chatter that I've had with other members of the media, even openly in press boxes as recently as a few weeks ago. We, as American soccer writers and journalists, have not really been fair to Jill Ellis, have we?
No.
We've been overly critical of her. And every time something happens, Daniel, right, aren't we, you know, every time we don't like a team selection, every time we haven't liked the formation changing from a 4-4-2 to a 3-5-2 and then ultimately to a 4-3-3, she went through this transition. We said, oh, Laura Harvey could do a better job. Oh, Paul Riley could do a good, better job. Oh, Tom Sermonti never should have been sacked. I include myself in that. I include myself in being on, I can't remember if it was this show or another show, saying, well, you know what? If Jill Ellis doesn't beat Canada in these upcoming friendlies, this was in 2017, she should be sacked. And we need to hire Laura Harvey before England does. And it turned out England hired Phil Neville. But we need to think about Paul Riley because he wins an NWSL. I include myself in this. And I know every – I'm not going to call out names. I'm just being accountable myself, but almost every other American soccer journalist has at some point in the last 4 years said, you know what, she got lucky in 2015. And I continue to maintain that, right, even on this show a week or two ago saying, well, if Lauren Holiday hadn't gotten injured or hadn't gotten suspended, Morgan Bryan hadn't been put in the team and Carly Lloyd hadn't been pushed forward, never would have won in 2015. We would have bombed out of the World Cup in the quarterfinals to China, and that would have been it. Now – I have to, you know, do a mea culpa here, and I'm hoping others will do the same because they've said very much the same things as I have. Like, you know, she won in 2015. 2016, okay, it didn't go well. But after that 2016 World Cup, now in Olympics, after we're eliminated in the quarterfinals, in retrospect, she said, okay, I got to change the way we play. Well, no, if we keep playing in this 4-4-2, we're not going to make it. We're not going to be a force in the next World Cup. And she was right. The 3-5-2 doesn't really work. I then criticize the move to the 4-3-3 and, you know, famously say, like I said in 2017, oh, if she doesn't beat Canada in these upcoming friendlies, let's sack her, let's hire Paul Riley, let's hire Laura Harvey, let's hire someone else. Let's bring Tom Sermonti back. Because I didn't like the fact that Kristen Press wasn't playing up top next to Alex Morgan. You know, again, personal preferences. Guess what? We play this new formation. We win the World Cup, and she found a way to use Kristen Press in the tournament. So I'm being accountable here. I and many, many other writers who write about the U.S. women's team or cover the U.S. women's team and the NWSL have said the same things I have, and guess what? We were all wrong.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, I mean, I was willing to give Jill Ellis you know, the benefit of the doubt. I was willing to see, you know, what did she learn from her last trip to the Women's World Cup, which was in Canada 4 years ago. I mean, I was willing to go there to say, you know what? I want to know what has she done in this time around. You know, how is she going to make these adjustments? What does she have to do tactically? What does she have to do with formations? What is she going to have to do with brand new players coming in, and what is she still going to have to do with the current veterans she has on this team? And if you really think about it, Kardik, and while there probably will still be question marks and there will still be, you know, more questions than answers maybe, I don't know, from some others, but personally, I believe that Jill Ellis has learned from her last trip in Canada. And I believe that she's done a great thing. She's done some great things. I think tactically, in my opinion, I think she's learned from her mistakes from the last time she was in the World Cup, and she found a way to get through those issues. And look, she's won two consecutive World Cups. Fine, she got lucky in that she was forced to use Carly Lloyd in a starting role in the final because of injury and either injury or suspension.
Well, Lloyd was starting. Daniel, I don't want to cause confusion here. Lloyd was started the entire tournament. She was the star of the U.S. team. It was that she was playing in a deeper role in that formation, and she wasn't getting forward as freely. She had too many defensive responsibilities in that formation. So that was the issue. And once Lloyd got sprung forward, she scored. I mean, she just did the scoring goals, right? I mean, you think Rapinoe and Morgan were great in this World Cup. Think about All right, and Ellen White. Think about how good Lloyd was in the knockout stages. So, sorry, continue. I just wanted to point that out. She played every match. It was just we didn't like
that's
the way
fine.
She was
But what I'm saying is that, you know, I'm not disagreeing with you on what you were saying, and, absolutely, that's what it was. But all I'm saying is that sometimes I feel like, you know, it looked like she learned from the issues that she did intentionally in the last World Cup, and she fixed those issues. And I believe that, you know, it took a lot of guts from her to sit Rapinoe down in the semifinals because of injury. That's what it was, injury, a hamstring injury. She didn't want to take any risks with Rapinoe being out for the final. And you know what? It took a lot of guts to do that. And you have to at least say from Jill Ellis, that took a lot of guts for not putting Rapinoe in a situation where Rapinoe demanding to be playing in that semifinal against England where she wasn't fit enough to go out there.
Yeah, and also I think in reality, when you talk about the Rapinoe situation, I don't want to get into the politics here. I don't know if that hurt or helped the team. She has a personal brand, political brand. I have to identify with it. For those who don't know, I'm a very liberal person, an active person who's worked in Democratic Party circles. But I don't know if that hurt or helped the team, right? Constant, you know, trying to exploit that brand. I think Ellis was smart in the way she managed the club in the clubhouse or in the dressing room or in training to not allow that to blow up and overshadow the overriding team goals for this tournament. It very well could have. And I think she moderated it well and kept the balance. And, yeah, there were some players like Allie Krieger and Alex Morgan who came out and said, you know what, we don't like Trump either. You know, we don't want to go to the White House. But, you know, kept that in check. She made hard decisions. She made hard decisions about roster selection. McCall Zerboni not being in this World Cup. Casey Short, you know, and here's another thing, Daniel. I'm going to be accountable again. I said the U.S. not taking Casey Short to this World Cup would cost them the trophy. That she's the best left back in NWSL that's willing to play for this team or else, you know, we know the situation with Jaylene Hinkle. That's another political thing. I don't want to get into that. But that not playing Casey Short, not taking Casey Short, when you have Crystal Dunn, who's not a left back, as your left back, it's going to cost the U.S. Not taking McCall Zerboni, who combined so well with Sam Lewis, and you're taking Morgan Bryan based on the last World Cup instead or other considerations. You're taking Allie Long, who I love as an NWSL player. She's a tough, tough player. She's won a lot of that. She's not a national caliber player, in my opinion. Taking her instead of McCall Zerboni, what's Jill Ellis doing? Well, guess what? I don't think anyone other than me just now has mentioned Casey Short in the last 2 weeks. Unless you're watching NWSL. I don't think anyone's mentioned McCall Zerboni in the last 2 weeks, unless you're watching the North Carolina Courage. So she got it right. I can't say it loudly enough. She got it right. Many of us were wrong. And that's why she's the manager and I'm not, by the way. Or any number of other people in the U.S. soccer media are not the manager. She got it right.
Yes, she did. She absolutely did. I'm on going through Twitter right now, Carter, and I just want to let everybody know, for those of you that are curious to know or you're going to take an emergency flight to New York City, my hometown, Mayor Bill de Blasio has just decreed that because of the 2019 World Cup – shoot. Hold on 1 second. I got to get rid of something here. There we go. I'm sorry about that. The mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, and let me just say this is my only political speech or my political thought. This is the only thing he's done right in his tenure as mayor of New York City. He says in a tweet to our 2019 World Cup champion, the U.S. Women's National Team, "You have inspired the entire country, and New York City knows how to celebrate champions. We'll see you Wednesday at 9:30 a.m. for the ticker tape parade down the Canyon of Heroes, and that means a trip up Broadway from the southern tip of Manhattan all the way to City Hall in New York City. Where or when it will be broadcasted on, not sure, but at the moment, Cardick, there will be a ticker tape parade for the U.S. Women's National Team in New York City this coming Wednesday morning at 9:30 a.m. on Wednesday, July the 10th. How about that?
That's fantastic. I mean, I think the nation's going to rally behind this team in the way that we have in the past. But great to see Mayor de Blasio step forward and do that. And I'm sure there'll be elected officials, politicians, both major political parties all over the country embracing this team, embracing their team spirit, their unity, their ability to bring people together in this country, and that's so important. Look, I mean, I have a growing problem with international football, particularly on the men's side, because I think it brings out the worst, you know, in nationalism, and we've seen this with, like, Croatia and Ukraine and Russian hooligans. I maybe I shouldn't be just picking on Eastern European countries, but we've seen it a little bit with the AO culture in this country around the men's team. We've seen it with some of the teams in Latin America. I mean, it just brings out some really ugly behavior. We see it with the Mexican national team fans. Now, hopefully we don't see it tonight at Soldier Field. But this U.S. women's team, it's very different. And actually the women's game is very different. The English women's team, the Dutch women's team, the way they brought together those countries, France in this tournament, bringing together French society in a way that I'm not sure the men did last year, even though they won the World Cup. There's something special about the women's game, and I'd like to – you know, I have my own political beliefs, as I mentioned earlier, but I'd like to keep the politics out of it. You know, Trump, de Blasio, they should all be honoring this team. Mitch McConnell, everybody. Nancy Pelosi, this is, you know, the best of America. And, again, I'm being apologetic here, but, you know, honor Jill Ellis, because we really beat up on her. I think she's been beaten up more by us in the last 4 years than Trump and Pelosi have combined by the opposite political parties. I mean, those of you who don't follow the women's game closely have not – seen the coverage and the constant criticism. And, you know, Daniel, you know, a lot of it come from me on this show saying, well, you know what, this team's not going to make it because she's meddling with the tactics. She's picking the wrong players. This formation doesn't suit some of our players. And clearly, you know, the formation still didn't really suit Lindsey Horan, who I think is one of the five best players in the world. But we won the World Cup in spite of it. So you got to give the manager credit.
You have to. And I want to say this as well, Cardick, and let me just – my only criticism, as we were talking about politics in this country, obviously, and the political climate is very, very heated right now. Obviously, it's coming from all sides, you know, regardless if it does come from the president and Donald Trump, if it does come from Mitch McConnell or Kamala Harris or Nancy Pelosi. Let me just say this. Two wrongs don't make a right. I do blame Donald Trump for, you know, going against the women, but I also blame Megan Rapinoe for her comments, because the reason is this. Worrying about visiting the White House during a tournament, in my mind, was a distraction. A distraction that we did not need as supporters of the women's game. What, you know, the women's team did not need, what the White House should not have done, just a bunch of, you know, distractions. Thankfully, it was probably nipped in the bud by Jill Ellis, but the truth is that we must separate politics and sports. This is how I feel. This is how I've always felt. I'm not saying you can't be politically this or that. What I'm saying is the political climate is too hot, it's too volcanic, and that we need a break from political discussion, and that's what sport is all about. Sport is about taking a break from the politics and just thinking about what does Jill Ellis need to do in this matchup against the Spanish, against the French, against the English, against the Chileans, against the Thailandians, you know, what to do against the Dutch. That is why I was very upset and I was very angry that all sides, got involved politically for no reason whatsoever. And I know that there are people on Twitter right now, they're so happy with what Megan Rapinoe said, and that's fine. You're happy with what she said? That's fine. I'm not happy with how the whole thing happened. I'm not happy because we wouldn't be sitting here right now talking about this championship, this fourth championship being won because of a distraction that should never have happened in the first place, and all parties are involved to be blamed for.
So Danny, let me ask you this question. Let's take Trump out of it. Let's take Kamala Harris out of it. Let's take Joe Biden out of it. What about the politics of the sport? Because Donald Trump is an extraneous factor. He's not involved in soccer. Nancy Pelosi is not involved in soccer.
That's right.
Bill de Blasio is not involved in soccer. What about Carlos Cordero and Sunil Gulati? What about those fans? Because I think this is a dilemma. What about those fans who correctly think that the U.S. Soccer Federation, in my opinion, correctly think the U.S. Soccer Federation has mismanaged things, has mismanaged, is suppressing the men's game. He's sitting on a surplus. He's facing seven lawsuits, including this one from the U.S. women that's going to meet arbitration. This is a dilemma. I'm asking you a question out loud because I actually don't know the answer. And as it turns out, you know, I keep getting drawn back to these national teams, even though I criticize the federation. If you're an American soccer fan, should you always be rooting for the U.S. team? Or do you say at some point, well, the only way Chuck Blazer's dead now, but Sunil Gulati and Carlos Cordero and Dan Flynn and Jay Berhalter get their comeuppance is if we lose. That's now really kind of the political thing I'm thinking about. Yeah, the Trump thing was interesting during this World Cup with Trump going at it with Rapinoe back and forth. But overall, I think there is a political element, a soccer political element, to following these national teams now that there wasn't before because of the growing dissatisfaction with the leadership of the U.S. Soccer Federation. What's your thought on that? Because I think that's a dilemma for a lot of people.
Well,
should I root
say this
for the U.S. because I don't want to root for the federation?
And let me say this, Kartik. Let me just say this right now. This is fair game. The politics of U.S. soccer right now is fair game because of what has been said in that Glassdoor review. The way that everything has snowballed for the men. Because let's be honest with ourselves here, Kartik. Carlos Cordero, Sunil Gulati, Jay Berhalter, Dan Flynn. And if you want to throw in Chuck Blazer, it's fine. You know why? He may be dead, but he's not, his innocence or his guilt. His guilt should not be thrown away.
He created.
It should not be thrown away. Because, because I'm telling you right now, Kartik, that political discussion about, you know, what is going on within U.S. soccer, it's fair game. Because right now, and if you want to go to the board of directors as well or the board of governors of U.S. soccer, that I guess they make the real decisions and not Carlos Cordero, because to me at the moment, the way it looks that Carlos Cordero is more of a figurehead president than an actual president of the sport in this country.
Yeah.
I right now have to say that we have a big, big problem, whether it's related to the men, the women, the youth, all of the above. I think right now we have an issue. And, you know, Kartik, not now, obviously, but, you know, I will get together. I would like to get together with you and you know, other members of the media and other members of, you know, coaches and everyone else that come to come together to do a show on it. I'll let you know when, but you know, I wanted to wait for this Women's World Cup to end and the Gold Cup to end later on tonight. Why? Because we have a growing problem right now, and the growing problem is still trust. It's still greed. It's still there's nothing to see here. It's just, you know, the alarms that went across the Confederation of CONCACAF, that went from Trinidad Tobago straight, a straight shot at the at our nation and the game in our nation, it's still an issue. There are still problems, and they're going to try, others are going to try to say, no, there's not really an issue. It was just a mirage. It's just a blip. It happens in world football.
That's what Sunil likes to say.
But guess what, Kardik? This issue should never have happened in world football to the United States. The growth of the game has been stunted right now. For how long it's going to be stunted, that's up to U.S. Soccer. That's up to Carlos Cordero now. It's up to the board of directors of U.S. Soccer. And even though Dan Flynn is stepping down, and Jay Berhalter, whether people like it or not, and begging for his you know, do not give him CEO position in U.S. Soccer. Guess what, folks? It's going to happen whether you like it or not, because they don't care. They don't care what you think. They may not like the media scrutiny that's coming after them, but the truth is that nothing is going to get solved unless there's going to be real change in how this game is managed by those that run it at Soccer House in Chicago, Illinois. Because right now, Kardik, the issues are clear, the issues are real, and nobody wants to take a real look at it. There are still real issues plaguing this game. And even though the women did a great job in winning this World Cup title, we'll see later tonight, 9 o'clock Eastern on Fox Sports 1, if the United States can defeat Mexico in the Gold Cup tonight. The truth is there are still issues regardless of who wins a title, who doesn't win a title, and what changes have to truly come in.
Yeah. So, I mean, whether the U.S. wins tonight, I expect them to win in the Gold Cup final. It's a Mexican team that's very banged up. Whether they win or not, I don't think that that has any bearing on the reality that the U.S. still missed the last World Cup, the reality that the U.S. youth system has stopped producing the level of players in mass that we used to. You know, once upon a time, we had, you know, we had four guys starting on a single Premier League club. Now we don't even have four guys in the Premier League, period. Five guys. Well, we had five guys on that team, but four guys started on Fulham. It's just we're in a mode where we're just not producing players. We're sitting on a surplus. There are all kinds of legal questions. I think Greg Berhalter is doing a good job. Daniel, you and I have spent the last year litigating the search process for the U.S. soccer coach. I don't want to do that anymore. Berhalter's the coach. We got to get behind him. However, he got the job. And I think he's doing the best job he can given the resources, which are and again, might win tonight because you're at home and, you know, Mexico is banged up and it is after all the Gold Cup. It's not World Cup qualifying. But there is not the level of player that we expect. There are teams in leagues outside of MLS going out of business constantly. There is money that should be invested in player development that is being generated by both the men's and women's national team. I want to kind of refocus this now. We talked a lot about the women's national team being screwed by Soccer United marketing and by the way the money is allocated. I also think the men's national team, the men are getting more money than the women. I agree with that, and that's a problem. But the men aren't getting as much money as they earn either. The money is going into Soccer United marketing. It's going into MLS. It's going into someone's pocket or going into, you know, the pockets of MLS owners. Some, like your club, Daniel, have reinvested that money in developing players. Red Bull have been at the very top. You know, some like I would also put like Sporting Kansas City on that list and Salt Lake. Some other clubs like New England and Philadelphia and Chicago are putting that money in their pocket or doing something else with them. So that's money that the men and women's national team players have earned that is not going back to them. Now, U.S. Soccer and Soccer United Marketing would argue, although, again, you can't have a conversation with them because they're not very transparent about any of this. You know, it has to be dug up by, you know, journalists like the Wall Street Journal or Bodor who's done a pretty good job with this sort of stuff. I know Bo's not everyone's cup of tea, but I like him, and he's done some good work on this. You know, uncovering some of these things that and where the money's going and what's being spent on what, that, you know, in reality, they'll argue that, oh, well, when the money goes to the Chicago Fire owner, to Andrew Hopman, he's putting the money back into the game. Is he really? That's, you know, I know that there's feelings that youth clubs that are not in the DA, or even some youth clubs in the DA but aren't affiliated directly with MLS clubs, are being screwed by all this. And they're producing less players because of it. We have the Andre Yedlin situation. I'm working on a pretty big story on that. And now we've got a situation with Rubio Ravine transfer to Utrecht and a few others that could come up down the pipeline that people are angry about. Because, again, they think, you know, there's been a screwing of the youth club. So there's all this stuff going on. I think it's important now that we have more people paying attention to U.S. soccer. And maybe they got drawn in by the politics of Rapinoe versus Trump. And we know soccer fans in this country like me tend to be to the left. Forget Trump for now, okay? You know, he you worry about that extraneous from soccer. Focus on Cordero, focus on Flynn, focus on Jay Berhalter, Sunil Gulati, and the late Chuck Blazer. I'm not sure Cordero's role. Daniel, I think you make a very good point. I hear he's been undercut. I hear that from some very good sources. Other people tell me, but, you know, he's still the boss. He still owns it. But so all of this stuff has to be ascertained. Now that we have more people paying attention to sport, thanks to the women's triumph, thanks to the men in the Gold Cup, I mean, that hasn't really spiked interest, but still it's going ongoing. Pay attention to U.S. soccer. If you want to politicize, talk about politics with the sport, don't worry about Trump. Worry about De Blasio. Let's worry about Cordero and company. And I would urge people to look at the reporting from it's the New York Times, right? Andrew Doss that broke the story about, we talked about it before, the Glassdoor reviews, but actually ascertained that that those were legitimate and that is pretty much the sentiment in the building. The employee, the people who had given their time because they love these national teams and they love this sport, are not happy. They're not happy employees at the Federation. And that's a big problem too, Daniel.
Yep. Now, that's the one thing I think we have to look at, Kartik. And, you know, once the tonight's Gold Cup match is over, like I said, you know, I've had Chris Gluck on to review these Gold Cup games with me for post-match. And, you know, he's been itching to get a say on it as well. And I've said so many times, Chris, not yet. Not yet. I want these international tournaments out of the way so that we can all get together. We can have a real discussion about what's been going on, you know, what the New York Times has reported, you know, the Glassdoor review of U.S. soccer has been going on. And all I can say right now, Kartik, is that, you know, there is still questions moving on within the game in this country. And the only reason why we care about this game in this country is because we want to see it succeed. It's great that the USA women have won 4 World Cup titles. It's great that the United States has won several CONCACAF Confederational Gold Cup titles. What we're missing now is simply put, we're missing a CONCACAF Champions League title. We don't have that fifth cup anymore. Back in the days when it's just a rinky-dink tournament that you only had to go and, you know, single elimination, you know, rinky-dink tournaments all over
the
place. The Galaxy won one.
Daniel, I'll jump in and say, in defense of your team, the one team in the U.S., the Red Bulls, Red Bull New York, had taken the CONCACAF Champions League seriously and tried to win it on multiple occasions, had then been screwed in league play. Because the league doesn't do anything to help them out when they're competing on the continent. I mean, again, you know, we if we win the tournament, I guess we'll talk about how big it is. But until we win the tournament, I think we're actively undermining our own clubs, like Red Bull, with some of the scheduling and decisions that have been made. So this is why, again, you need to hold to account the Corderos and the Flynns and Don Garbers of the world. Yeah, we all don't like Trump, whatever. Don't worry about him right now in the context of this sport.
Absolutely, Kartik, and that's all I'm saying. Well, Kartik, thank you very much for joining me today. On this entire tournament, and we got a Gold Cup later tonight, and of course, let's not forget we got some club action tonight, right now on Fox. Back to MLS action. The New York Red Bulls are taking on Atlanta United. I'll be tweeting that for the club, and then we go later back tonight on Twitter. We'll do a reviewing of this match tomorrow night on the regular 14th Club American Soccer Show. Carter, thank you very much. We'll talk to you again soon. Take care, sir.
Yep, same to you, Dan. You'll enjoy the Red Bull match.
Thank you very, very much. And I also want to thank Sally Villanueva. Unfortunately, she couldn't make it tonight today over at a watch party in Kansas City as, of course, everyone's celebrating over there. Everyone's still celebrating over there and all over watch parties across the country. And then they'll be back at these watch parties for the Gold Cup final as the United States takes on Mexico. They'll be live on Fox Sports 1. It's going to be a lot of fun. But I want to thank our Sally Villanueva of MLSfemale.com for joining me for most of the time in these review shows, post-match shows, Carter Kirchner as well. And all I can say is that, once again, congratulations to the USA Women for winning the FIFA Women's World Cup for the fourth time. Back-to-back tournaments now, and it's been a lot of fun. So enjoy the rest of your day. Enjoy later tonight. And join me tomorrow night for the Fire American Soccer Show. We'll review the Gold Cup final between the United States and Mexico, and we'll preview for the two USL sides in the Open Cup quarterfinal matches they'll be playing, New Mexico United and St. Louis FC, for their respective matches. Of course, that will be the coming Wednesday night, and then on Friday night, quarterfinal review show for the U.S. Open Cup. For Carter Kirchner, I'm Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you for joining us today. As always, enjoy your football, and I'll talk to you again tomorrow night. Take care, so long, and bye-bye for now.